This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, hello. Okay, great.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
This is Spark.
This is Spark.
Technology.
Trends.
And fresh.
Fresh ideas.
Fresh ideas.
This
is on the air.
This is
online.
This is Spark.
CBC.ca/Spark.
A teenager builds his own windmill to power his village home. Internet through power lines, and changing lives one at a time with African blogs. I'm Nora Young, and it's all about making grassroots connections on today's Spark. You don't have to be a geek to see that some of the coolest stuff about technology is actually being made by artists, not companies with big plans and bigger budgets. Just people who hack around with electronics making these fabulous, weird devices that show us how technology is changing the way we communicate, and especially how we relate to each other. Like, the other day I found myself on a side street right downtown during rush hour. Nope. Those aren't wind chimes or church bells. That's the sound of me driving down the street on something called the War Bike.
My name's David McCallum. I'm a musician and a sound artist.
And what is the War Bike?
The War Bike is a mobile artwork to make music or musical sounding noise out of wireless computer networks.
Yep, wireless computer networks. The same kind of network you might have at home, so you can use your laptop in the basement while your teenager's doing homework on a computer upstairs. But the thing is, wireless signals often spill out beyond your house. As David says, they're carrying with them your email, love messages, bank passwords, and credit card numbers. They all pass through your body without you even knowing it. The War Bike picks up these wireless signals and turns them into sound. So what kind of sounds does the War Bike make?
Well, it has two programs. The first program is a bunch of synthesizers that sound kind of like bells. And it'll make sounds based on whether someone's using a network that you're occupying and when it discovers new networks. And it'll also make sounds, the sounds will change based on whether a network is encrypted or unencrypted, whether it's locked or unlocked. The other program that the War Bike does uses samples, recordings of sounds, and it'll play wind chimes when people are accessing the network. The metaphor being that the network activity is flowing through our bodies or the space the same way that wind flows through chimes.
Wow.
And then also when you discover new networks, it plays church bell sounds. And that was a harder metaphor for me to figure out because I wanted to find some way of announcing that you were in a new space. And I thought historically coming upon new villages and stuff like that, it was the church bell that would sort of signify that you were in a new space or this was a new village.
That's great.
Yeah.
The War Bike looks like a regular shiny red bicycle, but in the basket on the front, there's a box with two little speakers sitting on it.
There, church bell, right in front of this person's house.
The War Bike gets its name from something called
war driving, which is the geek hobby of driving around with a laptop looking for wireless networks.
And ordinarily, war driving doesn't make a lot of sound. Usually you just see information on your laptop computer screen about the wireless network, its name, how strong it is, that sort of thing.
So what I did was I wrote a really quick little program to turn that information into a pitch. Started it running. As I got on my bike to go to school, I turned the speakers up full and put it in my backpack, and then just did that every time I'd ride to and from school. And it was this entirely different experience, going to school on my bike and hearing my backpack squealing, going wee, or feeling it in really low notes, because I started to recognize that it was happening in the same place, in certain places along the route. And what it started to make me reconsider the locations that I'd been by on a daily basis. It made me wonder, why is it making sounds in this intersection? And I really started to perceive the space differently. And so the War Bike was an effort to share that experience with people, because I thought it was so fascinating, and I thought other people would, I'd hoped that other people would find it fascinating too.
It really was fascinating and cool too. Well, I had to try it, right?
Yes, I'm riding a bike that's making music.
I felt a little silly at first, especially because you get some funny looks from people. But it gives you this sense of delight as you're riding along and suddenly you hear these beautiful church bells. And you experiment with riding faster or slower and circling around the same area, just playing with it. And every once in a while, there'll be a really beautiful sound that just gives you this feeling of awe at the hidden world around you. It's like it makes the air rich and thick and almost sculptural.
Because in a way, it's like a whole other level of information about a particular neighborhood.
Right. I mean, it's all this activity which you have no idea about, finding out that there's a lot more going on in a space than you can actually perceive with your own senses. And I want the participants to have to develop a new way of thinking about the space that they're in. I don't want to say pleasure, but it's like a sense of wonder, I think, about discovering these new things about a neighborhood. Yeah, it's mostly a sense of wonder and discovery.
The War Bike is at InterAccess Electronic Media Arts Center in Toronto, free for the pedaling until December 1st. And you know, I blogged about the War Bike at the Spark blog, and we got this response from Ian, who has also tried out the bike.
To my surprise, the chimes and chirps caused me to look into the lit windows as if to try and see the person whose innermost thoughts I was hearing in some unintelligible language, you know, speculating about their stories and their lives. In fact, the War Bike made audible a whole chorus of such neighborhood voices and stories. Well, it definitely put a smile on my face, and that smile, I guess, was pretty much the same as I'd seen on other faces as they returned the bike to InterAccess.
Why did the chicken cross the road?
I don't know. Why?
So it could send an email to spark@cbc.ca.
Ha, 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 ha.
Send Spark some love.
spark@cbc.ca.
Or check out the blog at cbc.ca/spark. Ha 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 ha.
And check out the blog for a great hack on how to boost your own Wi-Fi signal. All you need is a roll of aluminum foil and a glue stick, and you're in business. But then again, who needs Wi-Fi anyway?
Now it's time for the Gearhead Shit. This week,
Internet over power lines.
Okay, Jesse, so normally people have Wi-Fi so that they can move around the house with their computer, but you've got a gadget that lets you do that by hooking up to the internet using your home's existing power lines. Now, what's going on in your house?
Yeah, okay. Well, what happened, Nora, is I get my high-speed internet through the cable, just like people do through, you know, through the phone line or whatever else. And I'd set up a Wi-Fi network in my house because I wanted to get onto the internet using various devices. You're looking at me. Yes. Okay. So I wanted to get
research.
I wanted to get my video games to work faster, and the Wi-Fi really wasn't cutting it. You know, I live in a 2-story, 100-year-old house. The internet connection is upstairs on the second floor. The games room is in the basement. There were a couple choices. You know, the big one, of course, running 100 feet or so of Ethernet cable from my router all the way to the basement. But then I came across this. Now, this is what I'm holding is an adapter.
Right.
It's called a Powerline Ethernet Bridge. It looks sort of like a big plug, like, say, a phone charger or something. All you do is plug it in your wall.
Uh-huh.
You put an Ethernet cable into that, into your modem or your router or whatever. Then you take another one of these adapters and put it in any other plug, AC plug in your house. And you've got high-speed internet connection through your internet connection.
Okay, so you're plugging into the wall, but you still have to have an internet service provider?
Yeah, because the power companies in Canada currently don't offer internet service over the power lines, you still have to get the internet into your house some way.
Right.
So you're going to use a phone line or a cable system right now for that. This is right now in Canada anyway, used mainly for, you know, creating an interior network that's a little more secure than Wi-Fi. However, it wouldn't surprise me, given some of the movement in the States we're seeing, if power companies in Canada don't decide that maybe this isn't a business they shouldn't be in.
Yeah.
And of course, the other big advantage in terms of providing it overall is the power lines are already laying, so that you can imagine there, mm-hmm. Nora, the potential for, you know, remote rural areas, developing countries.
Absolutely.
Instead of having to lay expensive broadband wire, you can use the existing power lines.
Mm-hmm. And, or a lot of places in less developed countries, there aren't even phone lines, landline phone lines.
Exactly. Right. And we've seen the development of, say, cellular communications mm-hmm. here. But this would be a way to get them a high speed on the internet.
Right.
And of course, this is a century where connecting to the internet is going to be vitally important. In fact, a lot of, in terms of cultural democracy in the world, will be determined by who has high speed, who doesn't, and how fast we're connecting. Because the internet itself, of course, is actually free.
Mm-hmm.
Connecting to the internet...
Not so much.
Not so much. And in fact, we've already seen a class system develop where some people are still using dial-up, some people are using high speed, and your internet experiences are quite different depending on how your connection
yeah.
is. So this is a way that, you know, right now in Canada, we can only use this in our homes for networking, but eventually we could see this expand to where we can even use this as our main internet source, as our connection to the internet itself.
That's very cool. Now, could I do this myself, put these little boxes in my house?
Yeah, all you have to do is buy them. They're sort of expensive, about $150 each. So uh-huh. it's, you know, $300 for the two of them, and you need two to make it work. But then, as you can tell looking at it, it really is as simple as plugging the Ethernet cable in and plugging it into the
There's
wall.
There's a plug and a little thing for the cable.
A port, and that is it. And it'll pretty much, the lights go up and it's on. And I found it much consistent, much faster than my Wi-Fi connection. And I have to say, it's improved my Halo scores, Nora.
And that's really what it all comes down to at the end.
I would love to say I was using this to cure
Further the
cancer
cause of democracy
or somehow help the world. But no, it's all about defeating 12-year-old kids in Tokyo at a video game.
This has been The Gearhead Shed.
The Gearhead Shed with Jesse UMT.
What Jesse says about using power lines to provide internet access in developing areas is certainly promising. But what if you don't have power at all? How do you stay connected then? Imagine you're living in a small village in Malawi, in Southeast Africa. You have no electricity, so no lights, only a smelly paraffin lamp. You're disconnected from the outside world because you can't power your radio. That's what life was like for William.
Go ahead.
Hi, William.
Hi.
I called up William Kamkwamba on his mobile phone in Malawi. How are you today?
I'm good today. How are you?
It was a rotten connection, but his story is great. He solved the power problem in his home by building a windmill. How old were you when you built the windmill?
At that time, I was 14, 15 years.
His homemade solution connected him to the world around him.
So you didn't have electricity at home before?
Yeah, we don't have electricity at home before.
And what did the windmill let you power? What did you charge with the windmill?
And cell phones.
How many cell phones can you charge?
One that time I could manage to charge three phones at one time.
And here's the thing, he built most of it from spare parts, PVC pipes for the blades, an old bicycle frame to connect the blades to the windmill tower. He got the idea for how to build a windmill from a book on energy at the library, but it didn't have specific instructions. He figured it out himself.
I just draw like a picture of windmill. After I saw that picture, it encouraged me to think about it.
Now he wants to become involved in energy solutions when he finishes school.
Before I made a bigger windmill, I made a small windmill. That small windmill encouraged me to think about the bigger one.
Thank you very much, William.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's an amazing story. He's a very humble person, probably not aware of just how inspiring and how amazing his accomplishments were. My name is Ori Okolo, and I'm a lawyer currently working in Johannesburg.
Ori Okolo is also an activist. She's a Kenyan blogger based in Johannesburg. She keeps tabs on the African blogging community. Blogs are how William's story got out.
His story got picked up by a Malawian blogger, then got picked up by an African blogger who blogs about issues of entrepreneurship and innovation.
What do you think William's story tells us about the role of blogging in Africa?
It affects individuals more than anything else. Blogging really creates micro change in Africa. So it's not, we won't be changing governments anytime soon, but we are changing the lives of individuals through blogs, I think.
So can you give me an idea of who's blogging in Africa?
The kinds of people who are blogging covers a whole range. You have professionals, you have geeks, you have people who are interested in business, but I'd say if I could classify them, that they tend to be young, between 18 to maybe 35.
How common is it to blog?
I don't think it's common. It's not as widespread as it is in the U.S. or in Europe or Canada in this case. But I think it has mushroomed over the last 2 years, I'd say. When I first started blogging in 2003, I think at that time we were only three bloggers from Kenya. Now there's hundreds. I can't even keep track of all the blogs.
Wow. How are these voices different from what, you know, we in North America are used to hearing about African countries?
Well, they don't cover the typical, you know, poverty, disease, crime. It's different because we focus on our real lives and our day-to-day lives, and we're not, you know, all starving and poor. We're professionals. We've gone to good schools. We have dreams. We have ambitions. We're doing innovative things. If you want to get a good sense of just how diverse Africa is and a different picture of what Africa is about, I would say blogging is definitely the way to go. One interesting example is during the big concert.
Oh, yeah, Live Aid, yeah.
They, for the first time, you know, it was widely blogged and covered, and there was this great PR effort. But then you had African bloggers questioning the whole aid message. And, you know, for the first time, there's a bit of a debate and a bit more pushback from African voices. And my issue with a lot of these forums, for instance, the World Economic Forum or the G8, is that they're not representative of what I think is Africa today, or the young people. I mean, Bono is representing me at the G8. How is that? Mm-hmm. And I keep pushing and I say, okay, look, what can we do to challenge that voice? And I think blogs are one way that we do try and get the message out. There's people who feel strongly about it. And I think slowly the powers that be are starting to notice, or at least have an awareness that there are other voices out there and there are other alternative ideas out there.
Mm-hmm. Ori, thank you very much for talking to us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks.
Have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm intrigued by that idea of micro-change that Ori talked about, looking at local solutions tailored to local challenges. Like, cell phones are becoming mobile bank machines in some countries in Africa, where bank accounts are much less common than here, and lots of people in cities want to send money back to family members in rural areas. So in one plan, for instance, you take the money on your prepaid mobile card, and you transfer it to another user's phone. And that person takes their phone to a mobile banking merchant and gets the cash in return, minus a small commission. Cool, eh? If you'd like to read some African blogs, go to cbc.ca/spark for a link to Afrigator. It's a website that lists tons of African blogs, including William Kamkwamba's blog about his windmill project. On next week's show, what happens when Google Earth meets Second Life? They call it the metaverse, or the 3D web. We'll be looking at the future of the internet. And when it comes to seeing the future in the present, you can't get much more prescient than science fiction author William Gibson. Next week, I talk to William Gibson about his visions for what's around the corner.
Cyberspace is here, and we're here in cyberspace, except for those increasingly rare times when we're not, when there's, you know, go, wait a minute, there's no connectivity here.
Right.
And those times when your cell phone won't work, you know, when you can't get on, you can't check your email, those have become, for a lot of people, those have become like the minority, that's the minority of time now. So something's happened.
You can hear that whole interview right now at the blog cbc.ca/spark.
Technology.
Etiquette.
Is that how you say it?
Techiquette.
With me, Tom Howell.
I see no difference between checking someone's browser history and reading their mail or hiring a detective to follow them. What's next? I mean, hacking into your partner's email to see if she or he is really just friends with that old flame that stays in touch? I suppose the temptation might be there, but as they say, it's what you do when no one is looking that really matters.
Several years ago, I was in the middle of what ended up being a very difficult separation and divorce, and my mother-in-law at the time looked at my web history. And in the web history, she found what would be considered horrible, graphic, and probably even reprehensible adult material, which she immediately assumed was mine. She then told my wife, who is now my ex-wife, and of course it became a huge, huge mess. Turns out, however, that my sister-in-law was researching a paper that she was writing on abnormal sexual behavior. So I ended up coming out of it pretty squeaky clean. So it just goes to show how destructive and misleading this habit can be of looking into other people's web histories and just what kind of destructive force it can really have.
Those were some of the blog postings responding to our last Techiquette question. Is it okay to look at a friend's web browser history? And our Techiquette expert has just showed up again. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Nora. Techiquette expert is kind of hard to say, isn't it? Maybe you should call me a Techiquette expert. All one word.
No. Okay. So what's worrying you this week, Tom?
Well, you know how they're going to start introducing that you can use your cell phone on an airplane?
No.
Did you know that?
Kill me now. Really?
Well, it's kind of maybe in the world. Basically, what's happening now is a technological controversy about this.
Okay.
Or technologiversy, if you prefer.
Yeah, I get the idea, okay. Tom.
But if you ask an airline person about the state of things, they'll say something along the lines of this.
Passengers will be able to walk onto our aircraft 2 to 3 years from now on every flight, we hope, and continue using their devices in exactly the same way that they use them on the ground.
Actually, that is an airline person. That is Patrick Branley, who works for Emirates Airlines, and he was in Dubai. But if you ask him where cell phones will be allowed, he'll say something more along the lines of this.
Now, that's initially going to start on flights probably from Dubai into Europe, Australia, and the Far East. But of course, one day we would hope that it would be possible to do that on flights into North America.
By which he means they're not allowed to do it into North America yet.
How come?
Well, because if you are an airline and you phone up Transport Canada and ask for permission to do this, they'll tell you something a bit like this.
Here in North America, both in Canada and the U.S., it's our opinion that any of those, what they call portable electronic devices, so cell phones, wireless laptops, etc., could affect the navigation and the flight control computers on board the aircraft. And so we'd rather not take the risk of having people use their cell phones.
Actually, that is somebody from Transport Canada.
I guess that, Tom.
Her name is Lucy Vignola.
Okay, so why Europe, Asia, and Australia, it's okay to use your phone on a plane, but not North America? I mean, the technical issues you'd think would be the same.
The technical issues are the same. North America is being cautious about this. And the worry is that because cell phones emit radio signals, mm-hmm. and you know how GPS computer navigation systems receive radio signals?
Uh-huh.
Did you know that?
No.
Okay, well, they do. And so if the latter picked up the former, then as Lucy says,
you might get the wrong data as to where exactly you're located in the sky.
Which would be a problem.
Mm, yes, it would. But other countries aren't worried about that?
Well, what other countries are doing is gradually approving the use of picocell devices, which are very clever little boxes that live on the airplane, and somehow they keep the cell phone frequencies in line and make the whole thing safe. But from my point of view, forget safety. The question here is etiquette. Is it socially okay to make cell phone calls when you're sitting on a crowded airplane?
Bound to be a source of controversy. What's the answer, Tom?
Well, if you stop a bunch of people on the street and ask them their opinion, they'll probably say something a bit like this.
I have a friend who actually nearly got in a fist fight because some guy wouldn't stop talking on his phone.
I don't like it because I want to sleep, so it's noisy for me.
I'll spend a lot of time on the phone. Like, it's probably my most favorite thing to do is play on my cell phone and talk on it. So if I can do that to pass time on a flight, absolutely.
Oh, I don't want to listen to somebody talk for like 3 hours while I'm flying.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't want to listen to someone on their phone with their friends.
Opinions are mixed.
They usually are. And what's your opinion, tech expert?
Well, I don't object to people having conversations when they're on the plane, as long as they don't talk too loudly. But my objection to the cell phone side of things is that I can't hear the other end of the conversation. So it's quite distracting and also disappointing if it sounds like it might be interesting. So I'd be willing to accept cell phones. This is my ruling. I'd be willing to accept them on the airplane as long as there was a little button on my armrest that could tune me into the clever PicoCell device that lives on the airplane and could let me eavesdrop on all the conversations.
So you wouldn't have an etiquette problem with cell phone calls as long as you're allowed to spy on people, is what you're saying.
Well, I think it could be fun because you could use the channel changer to go between all the different ones and find the interesting.
Fun, yes. But, you know, it's true. That's the point, is that the annoying thing is not because people talk to each other on airplanes all the time. But it's annoying when you can only hear one side of a cell phone conversation, for sure.
Yeah, it makes you tune in all the more, I find. Well, maybe that's just my nosy character. But anyway, I figure as soon as they take care of the safety issues, perhaps it would be time to move on and deal with this little etiquette issue as well.
Thank you, tech expert.
Thanks, Nora.
Well, what do you think? Should people use cell phones on planes? Post a comment at the cell phone entry on the Spark blog, cbc.ca/spark. Staying connected, powered up, linked by mobile phone or wireless, sounds like the kind of thing that requires massive infrastructure and big budgets. But whether it's William Kamkwamba building a windmill out of old PVC pipe to power his home, or Ori setting up a blog to send a different message to the world, or even making Wi-Fi into music like the Warbike, some of the smartest ways of staying connected to the neighborhood and the world around you are grassroots solutions. We'd like to hear your grassroots solutions to fixing a problem in your community. Send us an email, spark@cbc.ca, or visit the blog cbc.ca/spark. Spark was made by Elizabeth Bowie, Tom Howell, Dan Meisner, and me, Nora Young. On today's show, you heard...
My name is David McCullum.
Jesse Wente. Ian.
My name is William Gangwamba.
Oreo Cullum.
John Bladen from Grand Cache, Alberta.
See you next time. Hi, I'm Nora Young, the host of Spark on CBC Radio. What is Spark, you ask? Well, Spark is...
Spark is online.
Spark is interactive.
Spark is a conversation.
Conversation.
Spark is digital.
Spark is a new kind of radio show.
You can check out the Spark blog, contribute to the show, and download the podcast at cbc.ca/spark.